This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 8th, 2019. Welcome, I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary, headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest. The big deal feature, the calm before the storm. Pollster Mario Canseco of Research Co. joins me as the clock ticks toward the official start of the federal election campaign. And Prime Minister Justin Trudeau appears on a Netflix comedy show and people are laughing at him, not with him. Plus, the Breaker will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or has it become politically incorrect to discuss immigration policy in Canada? First, there was that billboard campaign supporting Max Bernier's People's Party with the bold slogan, Say No to Mass Immigration. Complaints to Jim Pattison's sign company led to the cancellation of that ad campaign. Now, there is a guest column in the Vancouver Sun from an Alberta college teacher, Mark Hecht, suggesting that multicultural Canada ditch diversity and adopt cohesion. An online outcry driven by journalists from competing publications caused the Sun's editor to delete the column from the Sun website. While there are umpteen reasons to disagree with the message in the Maxime Bernier billboard and the Mark Hecht op-ed, is censorship the solution? Now, more than ever, Canadians need to debate and discuss immigration policy. It is, after all, federal election time, a time when we are supposed to decide our collective future. This is a nation of immigrants and the offspring of immigrants. We can never close the door to those who seek a better life in Canada because, in turn, immigrants could help better all of our lives in Canada. But we do need to talk about the numbers, and we do need to talk about settlement. The official policies of bilingualism and multiculturalism, are they working anymore? If they aren't, how do we fix them so that all Canadians benefit? Because no matter how deep the cultural differences are, communication can always overcome them. A common language can help overcome any of those differences and bring us closer together. Canadians have trusted governments for too long, but governments are run by political parties that want to renew their power every 4 years. So they pander to ethnic groups for votes and donations. Case in point, the quick win scandal in BC. And in some cases, politicians are beholden to those ethnic groups. Case in point, the South Asian-dominated taxi cartel in Surrey, BC. BC's major parties have let the taxi industry enjoy a monopoly, and that has kept Uber and Lyft out of the market. But that is changing. But the taxi cartel is throwing its weight around again, and it has the governing NDP scared. Could the taxi cartel and its allies at Sikh temples in Surrey find a judge sympathetic to their plight and help kibosh ride-hailing before it starts? Meanwhile, our politicians are afraid of upsetting the mainland Chinese community, which is also a source of votes and donations to political parties. Our politicians ignore human rights concerns in favor of economic ties with China. In doing so, our politicians are neglecting the smaller Hong Kong and Taiwanese communities. They came to Canada to get away from the Chinese Communist Party and Chinese nationalists. But the Chinese Communist Party's allies are here in Canada and they're twisting our politicians' arms. The housing crisis in Metro Vancouver was driven mainly by immigration of very wealthy people from China who were courted by our politicians. It only increased inequality. There are now homeless camps in the same city as $50 million mansions. But why isn't Canada more welcoming of refugees from China, hard-working middle-class folks who don't want to live under the iron fist of Xi Jinping, but would be ready to help us in Canada? Those are just a couple of examples of what's happening in the Metro Vancouver area. But the bottom line is this. The problem is not the immigrants. The problem is the politicians, who only see immigrants as a source of votes. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. Chelsea Boyle reports in the New Zealand Herald, Customs biggest methamphetamine bust at the border, street value $235 million. New Zealand Customs seized nearly half a ton of meth stashed inside a shipment of electric motors and arrested 2 Canadians and 1 Kiwi. If convicted, they face life in prison. The amount represented up to 6 months' supply of national consumption. Zhang Pingwei reports in the South China Morning Post, Taipan mooncakes pulled from shelves in mainland China after founder's son denounced for supporting Hong Kong protests. Mainland Chinese retailers have stopped selling a popular Hong Kong brand of mooncakes after state media denounced the son of the founder for supporting the protests in Hong Kong. Taipan Bread and Cake, which is best known for its snowy mooncakes, appears to have been taken off 2 of the mainland's biggest e-commerce sites, Tmall.com and JD.com, after Garrick Kwok, a company director, was criticized in an article published in People's Daily, the Communist Party's official mouthpiece. Mooncakes are traditionally eaten during the Mid-Autumn Festival, which falls later this month, so this is the peak season for mooncake sales. Bloomberg reports in the Japan Times, Japan will let up to 100 self-driving cars roam freely ahead of the Olympics. For 7 days next July, just before the Summer Olympics begin, Tokyo will let dozens of self-driving vehicles roam freely around the competition venues in the city's waterfront area to promote the nascent technology. As many as 100 self-driving cars will ferry up to 7,000 passengers in the week starting July 6, 2020, said Seigo Kuzumaki, director for the government's autonomous vehicle program. Car makers, including Toyota Motor Corp. and Nissan Motor Company, as well as parts manufacturers and startups, are participating, he said. Also during the games, more than a dozen Toyota robot vehicles will run a continuous loop within the Olympic and Paralympic Village to shuttle athletes and staff. Another self-driving Toyota vehicle, known as Concept I and packed with artificial intelligence technology, will accompany torch relay runners. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines from around the Pacific Northwest. David Rasbach reports in the Bellingham Herald, Feds indict 30 in alleged drug trafficking. 3, 2, 1. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines from around the Pacific Northwest. David Rasbach reports in the Bellingham Herald, Feds indict 30 in alleged drug trafficking conspiracy with Whatcom County ties. 13 people were arrested September... In 3, 2, 1. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines from around the Pacific Northwest. David Rasbach reports in the Bellingham Herald, Feds indict 30 in alleged drug trafficking conspiracy with Whatcom County ties. 13 people were arrested September 5th, and a total of 30 charged in 2 federal grand jury indictments alleging a conspiracy to traffic hundreds of pounds of cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine from Mexico through Southern California and to Canada in exchange for cash and MDA or ecstasy. At least some of the narcotics were moved through or exchanged in Whatcom County, according to the indictments. 3 defendants were arrested in Southern California, the release said, while the rest were arrested in the Seattle or Vancouver, BC areas, and 3 defendants will be transferred from state to federal custody. Some of the drug trafficking organizations included members of Canadian, Mexican, Serbian, Chinese, and Sudanese organized crime groups, according to court documents, and defendants reportedly used modified cellular devices with military-grade encryption to communicate with each other. 2 of the people indicted are Tinny Guan Lim and Vincent Yen Tech Chu, who have ties to Vancouver. Fedor Zarkin of the Oregonian reports, e-cigarette deaths climb as officials confirm some illnesses caused by oil in lungs from vaping marijuana. At least 4 people have died after using e-cigarettes, and about 450 possible cases of severe lung diseases are now under investigation, more than doubling the breadth of the mysterious illness that has gripped the country, federal health officials announced. The cases have spread to 33 states, most related to people vaping marijuana products, officials said. Oregon has reported one of the deaths, that of a middle-aged resident who fell ill in July after vaping oils with THC, the psychoactive chemical in marijuana. the state has reported no other vaping-related lung illnesses. And in the Breaker.news, these headlines. XVP sues airport authority after wholly flawed investigation led to unjust firing. Sevens players are not employees, says Rugby Canada in bid to overturn BC Labour Board ruling. And Hootsuite founder sues after West Van Mansion deal falls through. Read the stories behind those headlines in the Breaker.news. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.news podcast. It's the calm before the storm. Canada's federal election day is October 21st. By law, the Prime Minister must go to the Governor General to dissolve Parliament no later than September 15th. The campaign unofficially began after the spring session of Parliament. Some say it really began the day after the last election in 2015. To talk about this, we welcome back Mario Canseco of ResearchGo to talk about this week's events in Canadian politics. This was recorded September the 6th. We're looking at some of what happened after Labor Day, the stories that happened after Labor Day in this interesting period, the calm before the storm. First of all, we had the NDP, federal NDP, launching its campaign with the slogan, In It For You. There was the ad that featured leader Jagmeet Singh putting on his turban. In New Brunswick, the NDP is in shambles. There are several candidates that have switched to the Green Party. There are candidates in New Brunswick suggesting that the fact that Jagmeet Singh wears a turban is an issue for some voters. There are suggestions of racism. New Brunswick is mostly conservative. There's one NDP MP, Yvon Godin, and there's one Liberal MP, Dominic LeBlanc. So the NDP is really not a powerhouse in New Brunswick, and neither really are the Greens, but of course, many things can change on the way to the election day. What did you think about this? This was really the two-party battle of the week between the NDP and the Greens, not between the Conservatives and Liberals, it was between the NDP and the Greens.
Yeah, it was quite interesting to look at this as a situation of the two parties essentially trying to fight for third place. New Brunswick is not an area that has been particularly kind to the NDP recently. And the Greens have had a little bit more success in the recent elections that have happened there over the past couple of years. So I think there's definitely a little bit of a situation, if you're a third-party voter in Atlantic Canada, not necessarily only in one of the areas, that you could actually be considering to look at the Greens as an option. When it comes to the allegations of racism, I think the NDP should have expected that this was going to happen at some point after they decided that Jagmeet Singh would be the leader of the party. And to me, the biggest detriment continues to be Quebec. It's going to be very difficult for them to try to engage and try to maintain some of those seats that are left over from the 2011 election, when Jack Layton was the de facto only Quebecer who was running to become prime minister, and that were kept by Thomas Mulcair, who was also from Quebec, as the leader of the NDP back in 2015. So if they lose a lot of those seats, especially if they lose them to the Liberal Party, it's going to be very difficult for them to try to gain more seats elsewhere.
Now, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau sat down for an interview recently with the Patriot Act show on Netflix. It's hosted by comedian Hasan Minhaj. Trudeau did not look good after this interview. He was certainly uncomfortable answering some of these questions from a very well-researched, well-informed comedian who threw him a few barbs here and there, a few curveballs here and there. We also heard this week that Trudeau may attend only two of the planned five debates for federal party leaders. It appears that the Liberals are scared of that one dirty question, which can be turned into one attack ad by one of the opponents. What would you think, first of all, of this Netflix interview?
Well, I thought it was important for them to try to reestablish the way in which The Daily Show used to operate under Jon Stewart. I remember Barack Obama going on that show and Jon Stewart essentially telling him, so yes, we can, or what's the deal here? And Obama sort of fumbled, and that wasn't necessarily something that became an ad later, but it was certainly something that was shared through social media or through other channels. So I think they were expecting something that was maybe more of a softball interview when it came to the recent Netflix show, and it was anything but. So it's definitely problematic, and I think the fact that they've decided not to go to all of the debates is directly related to this. When he's unscripted, there seems to be a little bit of a difficulty trying to get messages across. I don't think they want to risk a similar situation unless they absolutely have to. So I think they will attend the two debates that are being decided already. But I think, you know, part of the situation here, and it's a tactic that we've seen with other incumbents, is to stay as far away as possible from those debates unless you absolutely have to. So it's quite ironic that it happened in the same week. The reaction to Justin Trudeau's showing wasn't that great on the Netflix show, and now they're deciding that they want to sort of keep him under a much tighter leash than they probably thought about this 2 weeks ago.
The drama teacher who is on message, who knows his lines, but when push comes to shove sometimes, those lines can't always help him if it's a question that he's not so ready for, and he could be really put on the spot in a debate, as he was put on the spot in this one-on-one interview on several occasions. Now we also have this week Maxime Bernier, the leader of the People's Party, who is defecting from the Conservatives, who he tried to lead, didn't win that. Andrew Scheer won that, but Maxime Bernier continues to try to set himself apart from the Conservative pack, even further to the right of the Conservatives. And this week he took aim on social media against Greta Thunberg, the Swedish teenager who sailed to New York to campaign about climate change and who could end up in Canada sometime during the election. Certainly what she is campaigning for has resonated with a lot of teenagers around the world, including Canada. But you had Maxime Bernier really take aim at Greta Thunberg instead of taking aim at Justin Trudeau this week.
I thought it was quite strange not only to do it, but to do it in three different times with three different sort of stream of consciousness tweets, which was quite something to behold. There's definitely things that can be discussed about the way in which this whole operation has been running. But I thought it was quite strange for him to try to attack the liberal elites, as they call them, consistently through somebody who is coming from Sweden to a conference in the United States. It didn't make a lot of sense in that sense, particularly because it's not something that is going to help him get any votes here. There might be somebody who is already deeply dissatisfied with the way this is going. We've seen that there's roughly 15 to 18% of Canadians who do not believe that climate change is man-made. Not all of them are going to vote for the a People's Party in the election, but I don't think it was the right way to try to engage with these people. There's nothing about this discussion that helps Canadian families or that engages Canadian voters. It seemed like he was upset because somebody else was getting the limelight, and justifiably so, that he's dissatisfied because he's not been invited to most of the debates, and there's been a difficulty gaining traction, and we've seen in our own polling consistency that he's one of the lowest, he has one of the lowest numbers as far as how many Canadians know who he is. So I can understand his frustration, but I don't think it was the right course of action politically to take it out on an activist from Sweden who is traveling to the United States.
Andrew Scheer made news this week, although not as much as some of the others in other parties. He released a campaign ad, a Conservative campaign ad, on the first day of school, showing what allegedly goes on in the Scheer kitchen on the first day of school. It was a hive of activity, the family getting together, and you had Andrew Scheer there helping out Mrs. Scheer get the kids to school. A very positive message, and trying to convey an image of just an average family and an average father doing what Canadians do on the first day of school. What did you think about that ad and that image?
Looking into two different things. One of them is trying to sell the idea of somebody who's going to be there for you, somebody who knows what it's like to have a family, to have to pay the bills. It shows them. It shows the Scheer family as a family that is typically Canadian. And that's one way in which you try to do things. But I think also it was a way to distance himself from Stephen Harper. I remember that criticism when he was dropping his son Ben to school and they decided to shake hands when everybody was expecting a hug or something that was more meaningful. So I think it's also a way in which the federal conservatives are trying to show Andrew Scheer as somebody who's more personable, somebody who's not as rigid and difficult as Stephen Harper maybe was in the first few years of his tenure. I think they're essentially trying to connect with some of those small-C conservatives who might be looking at other parties, and also trying to get back some of those liberal voters who maybe would have voted for Stephen Harper in the past and didn't decide to do so back in 2015. and by talking about specific issues like this. And I think this is going to be accompanied for sure by some sort of boutique tax cuts. That was very elegantly played by Stephen Harper in the elections that he won. And it's a strategy that certainly has worked for the conservatives. And I think Andrew Scheer will definitely try to do it.
Finally, we're getting closer to that September 15th date, if not sooner. Trudeau may go to the governor general and get this election officially underway. But it's taken 4 years since the last election campaign, and the parties don't all seem to be terribly organized. The NDP especially, but even the Liberals, are still trying to fill some slots. They haven't had nomination meetings for every candidate in every riding. There are some ridings that are the last to be dealt with, which are involving direct appointments of candidates. This is interesting. Is this a symptom of the centralized control that politics in Canada has changed, whereby the leader has so much control over the party, more than the party grassroots does, especially if it's the prime minister who the prime minister's office is all controlling? And is that the case, that politics has changed so much in Canada that the parties are really beholden to the leader, and they really aren't democratic institutions anymore? And are people worried about putting their names forward because they're worried about becoming an MP and being beholden to the leader, instead of being beholden to the people that vote them in and the people that pay their checks?
I think it's that. And it's also connected, in my opinion, with the difficulties in trying to find people who are better known in the community to run. We haven't seen a lot of former members of legislative assemblies, for instance. I mean, there's, for instance, Terry Lake here in BC running for the Liberals, but it's not something that is as broad as it used to be. You had a lot of people who ran municipally or who had participated in council who were running for the NDP or for the Greens. In this particular situation, the fact that the NDP still has a lot of ridings to fill certainly suggests that there's a hesitation from the membership in running in this election because they don't want to finish in third or fourth place, have their names in Wikipedia for the rest of their lives as somebody who got 7 or 8% of the vote, in some cases even fewer votes than that. So ultimately, those are all seats that are going to be filled. But I think part of the situation right now, especially for the Liberals and the NDP, is that they are desperately talking to people, trying to entice them to run, trying to tell them that they can win the election or that they can do very well if they decide to run under those banners. And the would-be candidates, understandably so, are hesitant and are saying, maybe this isn't the right course of action. I don't want to knock on doors and be asked why Justin Trudeau was so mean to Jody Wilson-Raybould or try to justify who the leader of my own party is. This makes this election definitely more complex. We've never seen a scenario where you're just a week away from the writ being dropped and you have dozens of candidacies that haven't been filled by two of the three major parties.
That was Mario Canseco of Research Co. Public Opinion Polls and Analysis. For more information, go to researchco.ca.
I, Justin P.J. Trudeau.
No!
Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways.
This is from the Two Sides of Canada on the Patriot Act show with host Hassan Minhaj on Netflix.
With respect to pipelines, you said getting consent from Indigenous communities is important, but when you were asked if consent is a veto, you said...
No.
Consent isn't a veto. Sounds like the worst Tinder bio I have ever read. Are you sure you want to stick with that?
When we're talking about engaging with Indigenous peoples, it is important to engage in responsibly and positively, but at the same time, to know that there are always going to be a broad number of opinions and perspectives within that community. We need to respond in a substantive way to their concerns and show that we're listening and working with them in real partnership. That's what reconciliation looks like.
I don't think that is what reconciliation looks like, especially if you ask the pipeline's Indigenous opponents.
You either respect us or you don't.
They have decided to willfully violate their constitutional duties and obligations. Why doesn't the Prime Minister just say the truth and tell the Indigenous peoples that he doesn't give a fuck about their rights?
I, Justin P.J. Trudeau.
No!
Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways.
The the virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a person or group that is making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Parkinson's Society British Columbia, which is holding its annual Super Walk fundraiser this weekend across the province. Parkinson's disease is a degenerative disorder that affects movement. Here is CEO Jean Blake talking about the work of Parkinson's Society BC.
Well, we exist to serve the Parkinson's community. So we have programs and services that assist people in their day-to-day lives. Learning education is a really powerful thing for people in terms of better managing their symptoms. We also do a fair bit of advocacy work to get better access to the treatments and healthcare professionals that our folks need in order to live the best they can.
The biggest annual event is this weekend's Parkinson's Super Walk, a fundraiser. It also gets awareness of what you do in the community. Last year, how much did you raise and how many people walked and volunteered?
Well, province-wide, we raised about $438,000, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly. We have 22 walks across the province, and pretty well all of them, except for the one in Vancouver, are totally run by volunteers. So we really are very grateful for all of their activities. And, of course, many of the volunteers are also walkers and fundraisers for us. This is a friends asking friends type of event for sponsoring them on the walk and donating to the Parkinson's Society so we can continue our work.
You can find more information on how you can help or ask for help on the Parkinson's Society BC website. It's parkinson.bc.ca. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 8th, 2019. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on September 8th in 1979, the Vancouver Whitecaps beat the Tampa Bay Rowdies 2-1 at Giants Stadium in New Jersey to win the North American Soccer League's Soccer Bowl Championship? Here's ABC Sports play-by-play announcer Jim McKay.
Season turned the team around immediately from a losing record and has had them going ever since. Last year they were somewhat surprisingly knocked out fairly early in the playoffs, but this year they've done it. We'll be back at Giants Stadium. The defensive player of the game, by the way, is John Craven, the offensive player. There is John Craven with the Rowdy shirt. You see, they've exchanged shirts, which is a tradition in soccer. He was named the defensive player of the game. The offensive player of the game will be Trevor Whymark, who scored both goals for the winning Vancouver Whitecaps. The most valuable player of the entire playoffs, number 23, Alan Ball of the Whitecaps. The trophy has been given there. There is the trophy indicating that the Vancouver Whitecaps, and don't get confused, even though they're wearing rowdy shirts, they are the Whitecaps. They have won the championship, and in a moment they should be having their victory lap, a great tradition in international soccer. We've seen it at the FA Cup final in England. You've seen films of it probably in the World Cup, and now the Whitecaps are going to share it with their fans who've come all the way, and with you Whitecaps fans who are watching on television in Vancouver. The Whitecaps had bad blood during the season with the New York Cosmos, and that's why you're hearing some boos.
Check out the BC Sports Hall of Fame at BC Place Stadium for a special exhibit on the 40th anniversary of Soccer Bowl 79. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. P-A-T-R-E-O-N.com/thebreakernews. reon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.